welcome, history friends, patrons all, to episode 22 of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. Last time, we detailed as far as possible the murky events of the early 1720s. We learned that much of Augustus's desire to rule independently in Poland had been shot by his negative experiences in trying to mould his own subjects, and thus his desires turned to handing the crown to his son rather than ruling Poland with any kind of pride or, for lack of a better term, backbone. With Peter the Great's death in 1725, King Augustus II of Poland was thrown into something of a quandary. Having negotiated and dealt for so long with the Tsar as his friend and ally, it appeared as though only Russian power would bring Augustus III to the throne after his father's exit. Without Peter the Great in power, it was not certain where the dispositions of Russia would lie. Would the new regime in Russia seek to honour the old agreements that Tsar Peter had made with Augustus, or would Augustus and his schemes be abandoned in favour of a new policy? Questions like these were all the more pressing to Augustus II, particularly as additional potentates began to express a renewed interest in what would happen to the Polish throne once Augustus II died. Increasingly unnerved, it remained to be seen what would happen to the House of Wettin's fortunes once the Elector King of Saxony died. As Augustus would certainly have admitted, though, Poland's prospects in the late 1720s didn't look especially rosy. In this episode, we're going to detail the complex series of negotiations and counter-schemes that led to one of the Poland-Lithuanian Commonwealth's most important turning points, the War of the Polish Succession. I will now take you to 1725. In her article on Peter the Great in Poland, the historian Louise Roberts observed the following consequences in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth by the time of the Tsar's death in 1725. She wrote, "Poland lay prostrate. Tsar Peter, with the aid of a blindly intriguing, grasping and extravagant king, had succeeded in dividing Poland against itself, had established Russia's right to intervene in Polish affairs, and had opened the way for the most complete exploitation of that country. Peter's use of Augustus was too successful to permit any deviation from the system marked out by him. Kings of Poland were henceforth to conform to the Augustan type, and if they could not all exhibit so many vices, they were always selected with an eye to the one vice of cupidity. Peter's methods were indeed calculated to make that vice common in Poland, and to make cooperative effort and loyalty next to impossible." We saw last time that in the murky and understudied years of the early 1720s, it became essentially business as usual in the Commonwealth for King Augustus. Displaying some uncharacteristic defiance in the Treaty of Vienna days between 1718-20, these years rid the Saxon Elector King of any sympathies or patience he may once have held for Poland's position in international affairs. From 1721 onwards, with the Great Northern War conclusively ended in Russia's favour, King Augustus had little interest in opposing his patron's grab for greater power. Where in the past, Augustus's known desire to install his son on the Polish throne had been used against him by the Tsar, once the situation had changed and the Commonwealth was dragged by Augustus to the Tsar's side, Tsar Peter saw the value in making continued commitments to the Polish king that Augustus III would be supported by Russia. This promise to see Augustus III sit on the Polish throne was directly contradictory to the promises that Russian envoys to the Sejm had made over the previous years. Here they had presented Augustus's pretensions to absolutism as unconstitutional and the Russian presence as the only thing that was saving the Poles from their tyrannical king. Once the friendship between Peter and Augustus was reaffirmed, though, it became clear that the professed belief of the Russians in the liberties of the Commonwealth's nobles were far from sincere. Tsar Peter was determined from 1721 to begin the process of closer Russo-Polish collaboration, for which his empire would later become infamous. Augustus's desire to further the compact between himself and the Tsar, and to ensure the latter's support in the Polish succession, were urgently sped up by Augustus's agents when it was learned in early September 1725 that Marie Leczinski, daughter of Stanislaus Leszczynski, one-time king of Poland between 1704 to 09, had married Louis XV, the king of France. For a bit of a recap, King Stanislaus had deposed Augustus with Swedish aid in 1704, and he did his best to reconcile the divisions of the Commonwealth as its new king, until he was forced to flee from Augustus's advances once the Swedish stock fell rapidly after the Battle of Pultava in 1709. The two men, Augustus and Stanislaus, thus had a storied history, and the fact that Stan had just married his daughter to the King of France ensured that his case for the throne of Poland would now be taken up by the most powerful unitary state in Europe. As was normally the case when it came to Poland, though, the King of France's involvement in the Commonwealth was not necessarily deliberate. Instead, much like the rest of the 18th century was to demonstrate, the Commonwealth found itself tangled up in foreign affairs owing to its central position on the continent, almost in spite of its own declining status. The French union with the daughter of a former Polish king was not a deliberate dig at Augustus then, but was instead the product of an intense period of diplomatic and dynastic negotiations, which only served to further illustrate the extent to which the balance of power in Europe was changing. Marie Leszczynski was a healthy but plain proto-princess, known for her poverty as much as her piety, and very far from the most favourable of catches one could be said to reach for in the early 18th century. Rumours abounded that the Polish noblewoman had used sexual favours to gain the hand of the 15-year-old Louis. There was also rumours that she was epileptic or infertile, but these whispers and accusations were merely additional shots which failed to pierce the thick skin of Marie Leszczynski. Raised in an atmosphere of exile, European wandering, and occasional ridicule, the Leszczynski family was regularly in financial trouble, and on a few occasions, Stanislaus Leszczynski had been forced to turn marriage proposals for his daughter down on the humiliating grounds that he couldn't afford the dowry. This experience had led the Leszczynski family into France by the early 1720s, and it had led, incredibly, to the circumstances where the 21-year-old Marie appeared to be the best candidate possible for the 15-year-old King of France. As it happened, Marie Leszczynski was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time, as the early 1720s had been fraught with internal conflict in France, as the different factions in the French court all sought their own advantage when it came to the question of the king's marriage. And this question of the king's marriage was a seriously important one, because in a France that lacked a male heir by 1725, Louis XV's life was one of profound value. If the teenage king died, then his granduncle, Philip V of Spain, could well be expected to invade France in the name of seizing the French throne. Such an act would undoubtedly spark a war, as the nations of Europe struggled to prevent a Franco-Spanish Union, as they had done only a decade before in the War of the Spanish Succession. That Louis XV marry and produce an heir very soon was therefore an urgent matter of life and death for the French Bourbon monarchy. Yet before a marriage with Marie Leszczynski could take place, Louis was already pledged to a girl who was 10 years his junior, the 4-year-old Mariana Victoria, or the daughter of Philip V of Spain. The reign of King Louis XIV has of course been our constant companion for several episodes and series in When Diplomacy Fails' normal feed, and in that time we've come to know precisely how ruthless, terrible and flawed the Sun King could be. All told, Louis XIV bankrupted and came very close to destroying the fabric of the French nation through his three successive Great Wars, launched for varying reasons, but all individually avoidable had one moved with greater tact and sensitivity. Yet in spite of all this for us historians, Louis XIV's greatest crime wasn't necessarily that he launched several terrible wars. No, instead it was the fact that he had so many children. By the time of his death in 1715, Louis XIV was succeeded by his great-grandson Louis XV, the Louis XV we still have now. But this startling testament to the fruitfulness of his family merely made everything infinitely more complicated for us. When we try to examine the different sons, grandsons, nieces, nephews, grandnieces, and great-grandnephews that were all running around, marrying their own suitors and forming their own mini cadet branches of the Bourbon monarchy, it becomes seriously hard to cover everything that happened. And the reason why it's so important to remain up to speed with the different layers of the Bourbon family is because of the situation Louis XIV left behind. The heir to the throne, the great-grandson of Louis XIV, Louis XV, was barely out of nappies when Louis XIV died, so it was necessary to appoint a regent until he came of age. The different stance of the regent could often affect French foreign policy, thanks to the dispositions of the man at the helm of the regime, and this in turn would affect the entire framework of the European alliance system. Thus, in the immediate passing of the son king, the regency was led by the son of Philippe and Elizabeth Charlotte, Louis XIV's brother and sister-in-law respectively. His name was Philip Auguste, and between 1715 to 1723 he was the regent of France, with the sole aim in foreign policy of maintaining the Peace of Utrecht, which had ended the War of the Spanish Succession in 1715. He also wanted to rebuild France after so many years of war. His European contemporaries were generally fond of him. Philippe Auguste was seen as calm, steady, and utterly loyal to the child king. Accompanying the regent's policies were the equally unyielding commitments of one Cardinal Dubois, who served as Minister of Foreign Affairs in France alongside Philippe Auguste. The two men, Philippe Auguste and Cardinal Dubois, made a formidable team, and they can be credited with ensuring that France pursued a new policy abroad, known as the Diplomatic Revolution, wherein France, Britain, and the Dutch opposed the alliance of Spain, Austria, and occasionally Prussia. But suffice to say, the Diplomatic Revolution is a really juicy topic, which I aim to cover in more detail in the future, and which we will certainly look on in this series. If that History of Prussia podcast that I'm planning 7 million years into the future ever gets made, that is when we'll talk about the Diplomatic Revolution in real detail. So you can look forward to that during the next Ice Age. Another reason why the regency in France concerns us is because, as we saw, Louis XIV's very descendants were all running around and seeking power for themselves. The best way to achieve these aims was to ally oneself to the regent or to the regent's rival for the sake of leverage, and thus you had the situation in the early 1720s in France where two major factions existed. You had the Orléans faction, led by the regent Philippe Auguste, and then you had the Bourbon faction, led by the grandson of the Duke of Condé. These two factions constantly sniped and schemed against one another, with Louis XV always caught in the middle. For some time it was intended that Louis marry one from the Bourbon faction, but the Orléans faction opposed this and saddled the young King Louis with a Spanish princess instead. This Spanish princess was, of course, still a member of the Bourbon family, but she was also 10 years younger than the French king, which wouldn't have been a problem except the unfortunate Louis was frequently plagued by devastating illnesses which aroused great concern in the succession-minded court. If Louis XV died from measles or something else before siring an heir, then the damaging power plays between the Orléans and Bourbon factions would be matched only by the turmoil caused by King Philip V of Spain's efforts to claim the French throne for himself. In circumstances such as these, where you had the choice between a foreign invasion or a civil war or both, it was necessary to find a compromise. But the campaign of compromise seemed in doubt when Philippe Auguste, the regent of France, died in 1723, and the Duke de Bourbon, Louis Henri, took power with his mistress. That the regent regime had changed from Orléans to Bourbon brought about a certain uneasiness in foreign policy. It wasn't clear if the headstrong Duke would continue on with the old French policy of friendship with Britain, for example, or rivalry with Bourbon Spain and hostility towards Habsburg Austria. Nor was it clear whether the old marriage selected for Louis XV with that Spanish child would stand. As domestic affairs changed, though, events occurred outside the control of the new regency, which suddenly cast the succession to the forefront of the political debate in France. In 1723, Louis XV was overcome with a grave illness. The child king didn't seem long for this world, and a priest was called to his bed to administer the last rites. In such circumstances, the old fears about what would happen if Louis XV died childless were again loudly voiced. The French government, as well as the French people, were desperate for an heir to succeed the then 13-year-old king, but such an outcome was plainly impossible so long as Louis was pledged to be married to his second cousin, Mariana Victoria of Spain. Of course, the problem with him being only 13 didn't occur to people either. Anyway, as the king's condition worsened, grave decisions were made about what the Bourbon regency would do next. Louis Henri determined that if the king could only get better, his bride should be immediately switched in favour of someone who was in a position to procreate right away. Mercifully for the beleaguered French, Louis XV did get better, and now the Duke of Bourbon had to fulfil his commitment to finding a new bride for his king, even if it left the Spanish deeply offended and displeased. The problem of suspicion and competition between the Orléans and Bourbon families coloured the deliberations, though, as any proposed family members were deemed too closely tied to one faction or the other to be acceptable. Any woman of good standing and able body was considered, though initially her wealth was required to be of a certain standard and a reputation of a certain standing. 99 potential matches, believe it or not, were located across Europe. These were eventually reduced to 17 potential matches. One by one, the two factions dismissed each of these proposed brides, including the daughters of George I of Britain Hanover, who would have been required to convert to Catholicism at the wedding. Anne and Amelia of Hanover were turned down by another important party, this one led by Cardinal Fleury, the king's tutor and favoured advisor, who we'll be hearing a lot about in future episodes of this series. Having been around the king since his early childhood, Louis tended to heed the advice of the elderly cardinal, who had become akin to a wise father figure to the fatherless king. In this case, Cardinal Fleury suggested that the two factions look further up the list of candidates, perhaps to those that had been removed early on owing to their lack of wealth. Before long, with more generous criteria in place, Marie Leczinski's name started to feature prominently in the discussions. Despite her relative lack of station and wealth, Marie did have quite a lot going for her. She was 21, of prime childbearing age for the anxious regency, and she was also known to be a pious Catholic, which endeared her to the cardinal. Above all, though, Marie's greatest asset was that she happened to be at the right place at the right time. She was seen as a neutral solution, which both factions in France could approve of, and her previous absence from any of the bitter inter-family feuds in France also recommended her to Cardinal Fleury, since he believed she would be a perfectly harmless match for the teenage king. So it was that the daughter of the former King of Poland came to become Queen of France. Over the course of 1725, old contacts were resumed with Marie, and the decision to have her wed to Louis XV was made known. Marie had been in contact with the head of the Bourbon faction, Louis Henri, in the past, because, incredibly, she had also been selected as a match for that duke. Louis Henri's mistress had pushed for the match, since she didn't view the plain and pious Marie as a threat to her influence over the duke. Either way, with Louis XV's marriage gaining precedence over his own, the Duke of Bourbon welcomed Marie, and saw that she was married by proxy in August 1725 in the Strasbourg Cathedral. The former Polish princess was looked upon unfavourably in the French court, since although her neutrality and fertility, gross, recommended her, her lack of rank and only fleeting royal experience tended to cause the over-haughty in France to look down upon her. Indeed, not since Louis XIV's brother had married the impoverished daughter of the Palatine Elector in 1672 had the match appeared so materially mismatched. In spite of these considerations and the condescending French, though, the encouragement Marie received from her father Stanislaus moved her ever onwards. It was, of course, an incredible honour to be selected for such a purpose by the French, and Marie, to her credit, committed herself wholeheartedly to the task. When they first saw one another on the eve of their actual wedding on the 4th of September, 1725, the 15-year-old Louis reputedly fell in love with the 21-year-old Marie at first sight, and the feelings were reportedly mutual. Louis was immensely flattered to enjoy the doting and loyal attentions of a woman who was older than he was, and he would remain utterly devoted to her for at least the first decade of their marriage, and especially once Marie did her duty and provided Louis with the son and heir which all of France desired in 1729. The European response to the union between Louis XV and Marie Leczinski was mostly one of amusement, while the Spanish were totally scorned that Louis had turned down his long-pledged bride, Mariana Victoria, without even bidding her goodbye. Mariana Victoria had been living in France since her third birthday, and her exit from France following her preemptive divorce from Louis was seen as a personal insult in Madrid, and especially by her hot-tempered father, Philip V. This incident provided further fuel to Franco-Spanish tensions, aggravated by the evident improvement in the Anglo-French relationship. Perhaps no other family so feared the ramifications of the marriage as much as the court thousands of miles to the east in Poland, where Augustus II fussed and speculated anxiously over what the union between the King of France and the daughter of his great adversary for the Polish throne could possibly mean. Desperate to secure his son's position still further, Augustus II determined to tie himself even tighter to Russian pledges, and the 1720s progressed in this manner. As Augustus II watched and waited, the history of abdication and civil war was never far from his mind. The marriage of Louis XV and Marie Leczinski established. The next incident to face France was the removal of the Duke de Bourbon from his position as regent, and his replacement in the post of First Minister by Cardinal Fleury in 1726. This rise to prominence by the Cardinal was nothing if not a striking testament to the investment that Cardinal Fleury had placed in his relationship with Louis XV, having been tutor to the King for the majority of the monarch's life by 1726. Seeing the need for a hand he could trust both at home and abroad, Louis logically chose the one man whom he believed he could trust to shape and lead French foreign policy in the turbulent 1720s. As the historian Cullen Jones noted of Cardinal Fleury, though, the old cardinal's rise was very far from a straightforward case of court nepotism. Jones wrote, "Everything had come late to the 76-year-old André Hercule de Fleury. His age on becoming effective First Minister contrasted markedly with that of his predecessors, Princes of the Blood, Orléans and Bourbon, who had been less than 40 when they achieved political preeminence. The son of a minor Languedoc tax official, Fleury had won the patronage of court grandees through precociously brilliant studies in Paris in the middle years of Louis XIV's reign. But his promise almost fizzled heedlessly away, some kind of misunderstanding with the king, who mistook Fleury's affable worldliness for libertinage, led to Fleury's exile from the royal court in the 1690s. His recall produced only minor recompense for a 56-year-old, a bishopric, but in a faraway and poorly endowed region of Frayeux. A ringing declaration from his Mediterranean diocese won him the belated approval of Louis XIV, who, just before his death in 1715, recalled the, by now venerable, sexagenarian to be the tutor of the Dauphin, and to begin a process of integration into the political life of the court. When considered among the great stately cardinals of France, Cardinal Fleury was the final in a quadruple dose of men who, though they donned the cardinal's hat, claimed authority from something more than the church. Cardinals Richelieu, Mazarin, the aforementioned Dubois, and now Cardinal Fleury all ruled France in the name of their sovereign during a time of immense change in the realm, and Cardinal Fleury's experience was no different, as Cullen Jones continued. There were some who ascribed the rise of Fleury and his continued tenure of office, down to his death in his 90th year in 1743, to a covert but ruthlessly single-minded ambition. No one who saw him at close quarters could doubt that there was a tough, dogged and spasmodically obstinate streak under the benign, affable and voluble face which he presented at court. Yet, Cardinal Fleury's belated and improbable propulsion to the top of the greasy pole owed as much to circumstances as to his own personal goals. What was to prove the most striking feature of his tenure of high office was precisely, moreover, a refusal to commit to a single objective, a determination to remain flexible and mobile. Despite his name, there was nothing Herculean about André Hercule de Fleury. He possessed the sprightliness of a hale and hearty geriatric, but shunned shows of strength. His proclivity was for placable accommodation and negotiation, not for confrontation or conflict. Balance was all. For the next 15 eventful years, Cardinal Fleury was to continue the policy of peace and rebuilding which had characterized his predecessors, a policy which included closer ties with Britain and a reduction in provocative foreign commitments. His preference for peace came as a natural result of his experience of war. Cardinal Fleury's diocese of Fréjus had been utterly ravaged during the War of the Spanish Succession, and he was determined to spare both his flock and the people of France such a harrowing experience so long as he was in charge. It was fortunate for Cardinal Fleury that the new diplomatic course was echoed in Britain, where a Whig ministry looked back to the events of the War of the Spanish Succession, the intensely costly conflicts which had been pursued across the continent, and the net gain Britain had received from its sufferings, and asked whether it had all been worth it. It was easy, of course, to blame the Tories for what had happened, and to look upon the monopoly in power, both military and political, enjoyed by the Duke of Marlborough, as a wanton abuse of the British political system. In place of that arrangement was a fresh commitment to see that the British gains in places like Majorca and Gibraltar be secured, and that the new threat posed by Russia and an Austro-Spanish alliance be combated. Combating Philip V's expansionist Spanish regime was to be aided by the acquisition of some important military land powers, such as Prussia, with its vaunted military strength and religious affinity with Britain, as much as its family ties, as George I's daughter Sophia had married Frederick William of Brandenburg-Prussia. Lord Townshend, leading the charge in Britain's new foreign policy course in the 1720s, had the following to say about the popular treaty between Britain and Prussia, which was signed in 1723. The extract is somewhat long, but as a primary source, I feel it gives us a really good indication of what both powers thought of each other at the time. Lord Townshend said, "The advantage of this treaty we have made there, which in effect puts into the scale with His Majesty the whole force and strength of Prussia, at least 60,000 men, excellent troops. Before this, the power of Great Britain lay only in its fleet, which, though strong and of great command in maritime causes, yet as everybody saw how low the States General were with the jealousies and distrusts that were fomented between the King and His Prussian Majesty, and that we had no land forces to spare, the respect our fleet carried could not spread its influence so far as was necessary. But now this strict union is made with the King of Prussia, and His Majesty is become master, as if it were, of so mighty a land force. He will not only be more secure, but also more respected both in the north and south, and have it in his power to act more independently from the houses both of Austria and Bourbon, and preserve the peace of Europe with less submission to the terms of either. The union so established must be lasting, because the King of Prussia cannot but have the same views and interests with His Majesty in those respects. Besides, this will sound well in England." Unfortunately for Townshend, though, he failed to grasp the possibility that external events would move Prussia to follow its own independent policy course that had nothing to do with British interests. In the meantime, though, Britain tried to solidify its alliance with France and the Dutch, while France, under Cardinal Fleury, signed additional agreements with Bavaria and the Palatinate, mainly in a bid to separate as many German princes as possible from the Austrian Habsburgs. The French were deeply concerned that the Duke of Lorraine's son, Francis, was getting a bit too close for comfort with the Holy Roman Emperor's daughter. A marriage between the daughter of the Holy Roman Emperor and the Duke of Lorraine would have placed Lorraine in an unassailable position, and if he was not careful, Cardinal Fleury could preside over a nightmarish scenario in foreign affairs, where the previously weak family in Lorraine ascended to the office of Holy Roman Emperor with all the strength and danger to the French position which that implied. It was imperative that the Duke of Lorraine was kept away from the Habsburgs, but this proved impossible, so to compensate, the French and British sought to ensure the improvement of relations between Bavaria and Saxony, which would throw a wrench into events in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. All of these apparently far-off negotiations trickled down into Poland. By complicating Augustus II's relationship with his German peers, the Anglo-French diplomacy aimed at muddying the waters where both Augustus and his Polish dependencies were concerned. Through Poland-Lithuania, they could also hope, with some luck and tenacity, to reach out to the Russians in a bid to further pressure Vienna. The wild card in these developments continued to be Russia, which, even after Peter the Great's death in 1725, continued to benefit from the aftermath of its successful Great Northern War and firm Polish ally, which granted it a really favourable strategic position. It was fortunate that Peter had left the Russian Empire with a stable imperial base, because the Russian succession proved to be anything but stable. Between 1725 to 30, Russia saw a succession of two empresses and one emperor, as the grandsons, daughters of half-brothers, and any other heirs that could be found were trotted out in a bid to stabilise the Russian succession, until the ascension of the daughter of Peter the Great's half-brother Ivan V, the Empress Anna, in January 1730, Russia's Romanov family, and thus its foreign policy, struggled to find a footing. And that's why we hadn't really looked at it until now. Russia was strangely uninvolved in things that were happening in the late 1720s, but with the ascension of Anna, that was all to change. In fact, this trend of Russian inaction was reversed just in time to deal with the looming succession crisis in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Augustus II was evidently fading as the 1720s progressed, as were his efforts to represent the Polish crown independently. By the time of Empress Anna's coronation, Augustus had ensured that the Commonwealth was thoroughly enmeshed in Russian interests, at the expense of Polish sovereignty. In stark contrast to the bright sparks of independent and defiant action between 1710 to 20, Augustus, by 1730, was closer to a Russian vassal than he ever had been, and the decade between this transition had not been kind either to his own peace of mind or his reputation. Forced to rely totally on Russian patrons for their guarantees as to his son's succession, Augustus's beleaguered subjects were themselves in no position to resist what was to come. Next time, our analysis of the era continues as Europe edged ever closer to a conflict it did not want over a crown it did not understand. I hope you'll join me for that then, history friends and patrons, as we continue our examination of the very detailed, sparse years of the 1720s. Thanks so much for listening to this show and supporting it. I really appreciate it so much. But until next time, my name is Zach. This has been episode 22 of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. You're a wonderful patron. Thanks for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.